Hello and welcome along to episode 9 of the Director's Box podcast. I'm Kevin Harper, and as always, I've got Craig Gill alongside me. Craig, how are you doing, mate?
I'm very well, Kevin. Thank you. How are you?
Yeah, all good. All good. We are recording this slightly later than normal. That is not because I've only just recovered from Luton's win over Bournemouth at the weekend. It's so that we could incorporate the Champions League quarterfinals and the midweek championship action, which we will do on this episode of the podcast. But before we get to that, we're going to have an in-depth discussion about the role of the striker. I've got a former striker alongside me, so it's good to tap into the insights of Craig with regards to that. And then we will also look at a couple of big matches that are coming up this weekend, and we'll also touch on the Old Firm derby that was played last weekend too. How does that all sound, Craig?
Sounds great, Kevin. Looking forward to it.
Excellent. Let's get stuck in then. Let's start with the role of the striker, Craig, because the one thing that we'll take that we've taken from these Champions League quarterfinals, which we'll discuss in more detail later in the podcast, the role of the striker. We got to see possibly the three best sort of what you would class as out and out number nines in world football in these quarterfinals. Obviously, there was Erling Haaland, there was Harry Kane, and then you have sort of Robert Lewandowski as well at Barcelona. Obviously, Manchester City, Bayern Munich before those. But the role of the striker, it's different now, isn't it? If you was a football fan 20 years ago, you'd probably be looking at a striker who could play alongside another striker up top, wouldn't you? Whereas these days, the more successful sides, in fact, pretty much every team in the Premier League and most top teams in the leagues around the world, they kind of play with one sort of, if you were a number nine, with two sort of wide wingers alongside them, whether they're inverted wingers or whether they're wide wingers. So in that, the role of the sort of central striker, the number nine, so to speak, is changing, isn't it? Just talk to us a little bit about that sort of different dynamic, not having that immediate strike partner alongside you, and, you know, the work that you obviously have, it is different because there's three of you, but you're the focal figure now.
Yeah, I think back in the day, as you said, you know, it was the standard sort of two up front, wasn't it? And if you look at formations wise, you know, a lot of teams, especially in the English leagues, played 4-4-2. So you had generally a target man with then a striking partner who might be a little bit pacier, might be a little bit trickier, if you like, who would play off the central striker, and they would work in partnership. So one might drop off and then the other one then might go long for balls played in behind. And obviously the central striker then obviously, you know, would be the link player, that, as the name suggests, target player. You look to play balls into him, and then the second striker would play off it, or the ball would be playing the target player. He would set it back for a midfield player, and then they would spring the second striker, or indeed one of the two wingers in wider areas. So the 4-4-2 was a classic. I mean, you know, there are some great combinations over the years. Are they striking partners? You know, I remember Euro 96, I think it was Shearer and Sheringham particularly. And then going back, you know, to when Liverpool first started their success back in the 70s, you know, it was Toshack, who was a big target man, and Keegan, who was a smaller, quicker guy, if you like. But as you say, now things have evolved, and a lot of teams now are playing with a lone central striker, a number nine, if you like. But what seems to have happened is that second striker has now dropped into that number 10 role, hasn't he, if you like. So a lot of teams, you know, one of the most common formations these days is 4-2-3-1. So you've got four defenders, obviously, two central defenders, two wide defenders. Then you've got two sort of more defensive midfield players, if you like, a double pivot. And then in front of them, you've got the number 10, of which obviously, you know, Messi is a classic example. Then to make that three alongside the number 10, you've got two wingers, right and left. And then the one up front is obviously your target man, as we said. So if you look at the three names that you just mentioned there, Haaland, Kane and Lewandowski, they are of that physical set, if you like, strong, powerful, but protect the ball well, link the play effectively. And of course, you know, there was a time, certainly when Spain was so successful in the World, winning their World Cup and European Championships, whereby they played with a false nine, of course, and they didn't have an out-and-out centre forward as such. So, yeah, the role of the striker is fascinating, and you know, it's one which in today's game is pivotal, because obviously a lot of balls get played up, then get set back, and then, you know, they use that as a platform then in build-up play and also in the final third, obviously. And of course, you know, the benefit and the strengths of a powerful target man at set pieces, both in possession, corners, free kicks, for example, from wide areas, and of course then going back into his own penalty box to defend such set pieces as well.
So I think sort of analytics and everything else has come into the game an awful lot more in the last 10 or 15 years, hasn't it? Whereas before, analysis was so strong and so in-depth, and you know, technology was what it is now. I think largely the main striker was judged on his goal output. Can he get us 20 goals in the top flight? Can he get us sort of 15 goals? Can he score in the sort of big matches? Can he be the one to lead the team to success? And I guess that's still the case. You obviously want your centre forward to score goals. If he doesn't score goals, you know, chances are you're going to be in a spot of bother. But he needs to do an awful lot more than just score goals now, doesn't he? He needs to link up the play, as you mentioned. He needs to bring bring his teammates into the game, but he also needs to take defenders out of the game for his teammates to then have the space and the luxury of the space for them to exploit. So presumably the coaching of the striker is going to be an awful lot different now, because he has to make completely different runs. Whereas back in the day, the target man would literally have just have pinned the centre half, wouldn't he? And then, you know, he's there for flick-ons or whatever. Whereas now, a lot of nines, as you just mentioned, they've got to come short to kind of bring one of the centre backs out to free up that space for either the winger or the 10. And it's a whole lot more of a complex position these days.
Yes, I agree. And, you know, if you think back to the, you know, the Toshack Keegan, for those that can remember that, some of our older fans, if you like, some of our older listeners, will remember the Toshack and Keegan era, where it was just that balls were played in the air at the Toshack. He would get there first, obviously, with his huge stature. Very powerful man. He would flick the ball on in behind the back. Keegan, generally, would then run from a slightly deeper position, beating any offside, and then go and finish. And it was a well used and very successful tactic. Obviously, you know, the role of the striker is, as you said, yes, to help in link up play and be that target player, but ultimately it's you know, he's got to be there on the end of things and convert chances when they come, you know. So that's important as well, vital in fact. I think when you look at the three that we've named, Harry Kane particularly is very good at dropping in slightly deeper, maybe dropping into midfield areas and getting on the ball and starting things off from there. You know, whereas others might actually be more adept at maintaining a high line and then playing in those, you know, those more advanced areas, if you like.
As a sort of coach yourself, how would you set your sort of, presumably, are you in the modern way that you would play one with two wide, and therefore would you ask your striker to stay up the field, or are you asking him to come back and sort of do the Harry Kane role, so to speak?
Well, personally, I coach, and obviously coaching out here in the States with a youth football club at the moment. I like to play 4-2-3-1, because I think it gives you lots of options, building out from the back, lots of passing options, triangles and diamonds, obviously. But also it allows you to play with width, because obviously you've got your two wingers in effectively, if you want to call it, a five-man midfield per se. And then I get my strike, and then to stretch the play, to make the pitch as long as we possibly can. And of course, by stretching the back four as far as he can or she can, then Obviously, you make the pitch as big as possible with width-wise and length-wise. And of course, then that creates more time and space for not only each individual player, but particularly for midfield players, potentially. So that's where I like to play. And then obviously by playing out from the back and looking to play through midfield players, you'd hope then I try and get my number 10 then, who used to be the second striker, as we said. The number 10 then looks to play between units, looks to play between their midfield unit, their deep line midfield player, if you like, tries to escape him or her, and then tries to play in the space between the midfield unit and the back line, which hopefully the striker's created by taking that back line as far as they can, as far as he or she can. Now, obviously, that all depends then on what the opponents do. So if the opponents play with a high press and they play with a really high back line, some teams, as you've probably seen already, it's quite a common theme these days for defenders or defending line, back lines to, you know, to defend quite high in the opponent's half, which can be a fantastic tactic. Unless, of course, your lines get broken, and then, of course, then you're retreating on your back foot, and then you're trying to absorb the attack then, as opposed to trying to win it high and play with a high line.
I guess there's a psychological sort of aspect to all of this as a striker as well, isn't it? Sort of back in, the time when you was involved in football as a player, a striker would have to be selfish, wouldn't he? As I said, he'd be judged purely on his goal output. So he's therefore, if the chance comes, he's got to put the ball in the back of the net. Now it's not really like that, is it? Now the striker has to be more of a team player. And I'm thinking, you know, if you're going through one-on-one with the goalkeeper and you've got your mate alongside you who's got an easier tap in than you, who would have to beat the goalkeeper, for example, the coaches these days are encouraging the ball to be played across for the easy tap in rather than the number nine who's done all of the sort of hard work to get into the position to then take his chance and potentially risk the goalkeeper saving it. It's, you have to be a lot more of a team player, a lot less selfish than the striker would have had to have done back in the day.
That's an interesting one, Kevin, because I know some strikers now who would rather take a shot at goal than potentially playing another option, shall we say, because I think strikers, you know, certainly at top level, are fairly single-minded. Obviously, players clearly, yes, but by the same token, you know, there's no greater feeling for a striker than scoring goals, obviously. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the way teams are set up now, and probably have been, to be honest with you, you know, you'd rather the team scored and you not score than you score or miss, you know, or you get saved and you don't capitalise, you know. I mean, obviously, the ideal situation is that you score and your team wins. That's as a striker, that's what you want. But yeah, I think if there's any doubt at all, and if the striker's confident, he's probably going to take on that opportunity, unless it's an obvious, you know, an obvious square ball where, you know, you draw the keeper and you open the goal up for a teammate. You know, if there's any doubt at all, I think most strikers would take the shot, to be honest.
Yeah, that's fair enough. As I say, that's what they're in the team for. That's what they're brought to do, score goals. And find me a striker who doesn't like the feeling of scoring a goal, and I'll show you a striker I don't want in my team, to be quite honest with you. That's how it is. Strikers are there to score the goals. Defenders are there to keep them out at the other end. But the role of the striker, it is definitely changing, and it's probably going to continue to evolve. Football's a very cyclical business at the moment, and evolving of positions on the pitch is certainly part of that. We gave you just an example there of three of the very best strikers, but you know, you can look way down the list. Certainly in the Premier League, all of the teams do similar things. They just do it. You know, some do it better than others, and that's why the best are the best and the rest aren't. So thanks for your insights with regards to that position, Craig, and we may well get more insights into other positions in other podcasts as we go along, particularly once this wonderful football season draws to a close and we're looking for other things that we can bring to the listeners over the course of the summer and things. Let's do concentrate on the current football, though, because as we've said for many a week, there are some fantastic title races and relegation battles and everything else going on across England and also Scotland, Craig. And we got another look into where the Scottish Premiership might or might not be going at the weekend for a large part of the Old Firm derby on Sunday afternoon. It looked like Celtic were going to steal a march on Rangers and they were going to go 4 points clear of them. They're ahead within 20 odd seconds. Absolutely crazy start to the game. And then they doubled their lead with a penalty midway through, or sort of towards the end of the first half, should I say. But, you know, Rangers, backed by a sort of full house, didn't give in. They didn't give up on anything. The second half was absolutely crazy, one way, then the other. And ultimately, we ended with a 3-3 draw, which is probably that result that suits neutrals the best, because this race is going to sort of keep on running. And what did you make of the game? Lots of penalty shouts, two penalties given, two penalties scored, late goals, early goals. Yeah, it was just a classic Old Firm derby, wasn't it?
It was for the neutral, it was great, wasn't it? It was fantastic. I didn't get to see the game myself, but obviously was trying to follow, you know, on social media. And yeah, what a game it turned out to be, as you said. That goal in the first 20 seconds, ball coming off Mead, I think Tavernier, I think, trying to clear it. Mead closed him down and obviously the ball rocketed into the bottom corner past Buckland. And as you say, then the game unfolded. Obviously, then Celtic went 2-0 up with the penalty, as you said. And then Tavernier, who's got an incredible record, you know, for a right back. It was something that my son James pointed out to me, who's a Rangers fan, as I might have mentioned before. You know, he scored 132 goals in 451 games, making him the highest scoring defender in British football. That's phenomenal, you know, for a right back. 132 goals is phenomenal, really. And of course, he's the captain as well, so, you know, leading by example, etc. And I remember it used to be going back to the Toshack Keegan era, if you like. And then it was a right back I used to play for Liverpool called Phil Neal, who later became a friend when we became manager at Cardiff City. And I did a bit of work with them. We did a pre-season training camp at the military base in South Wales, where I was based. So I got to know Phil and Kenny Hibbert, who were at Cardiff at the time. But I know he had a great goal scoring record as well, but obviously the majority of his goals were scored by penalties, and I'm sure Tavernier's are as well. But by the same token, he does score goals from, you know, from open play and gets in at the far post on a regular occasion. So that was interesting. That was a little piece that I picked up, and thanks to James for that. But then obviously, you know, that was it, 2-1. Seema then scored, didn't he, in the 86th minute. And it was Rabbi Matondo, actually, a player who I had the fortune to coach. He was at Cardiff City at the time, actually, and I was coaching with the Football Association of Wales, the regional national squads. And Rabbi was in one of our under 15 groups, I think it was, for South Wales. But he actually cut inside from the left hand side and hit a shot across the goal, which then got rebounded out, and then Seema followed up and rifled in. Then we went down the other end, and Ida scored in the 87th minute, so a minute later. And then you think, surely now, you know, Rangers are broken. You know, they were 2-0 down, they come back to 2-2. Celtic go 3-2 up. Surely this is how it's going to finish. And then lo and behold, Rabbi Matondo tries the same skill again. Feints to go outside the fullback, cuts back inside, sends a rocket right into the opposite corner, top corner. A great goal to equalise, and the game finished 3-3. And what a game it was!
Yeah, another one of the many late goals that have impacted the leagues this season. Yeah, really, really good Old Firm game. And as I say, it keeps everything nicely balanced as we head towards the split in the division that will conclude the Scottish Premiership season. Rangers very, very unhappy on Wednesday night with the late cancellation of their game at Dundee, which was previously cancelled before then. And probably a legacy of not winning that Old Firm game. They want to get top of this table, don't they? They want to get top as quickly as they possibly can. And further delays are just hampering them. But we will follow the remainder of the Scottish Premiership season as we go along. There's still plenty of mileage left in that title race. thanks to that last minute equaliser, or sorry, late equaliser, it wasn't last minute, there was still a few more minutes to play after the Matondo equaliser. We'll follow that in full. Another thing that will follow in full, Craig, is the conclusion of the Champions League. And we've had four wonderful first legs of the quarterfinals this week. There used to be a time where the first legs of these two-legged ties were tight, nervy, tense affairs. The time really when away goals were in sort of force, and the home team in the first leg would just be desperate not to concede an away goal, and it would all get a bit edgy. But since away goals have been done away with, we've got nothing to worry about in that regard. We've had goals galore in the first legs, and also plenty of controversy as well, it has to be said. And I guess we have to start at the Emirates Stadium, Craig, because brilliant game of football between Arsenal and Bayern Munich. Two really, really good sides to watch. Particularly in this first leg, with Arsenal pushing and Bayern Munich happy to soak up and try and hit them on the counter-attack. The Harry Kane factor involved as well. It ended 2-2, but there were two massive incidents in the game. The first one, you probably wouldn't have noticed if you weren't paying real close attention to the game. But there was an incident midway towards the late end of the second half. David Raya has put the ball down to take a goal kick. He has clearly taken the goal kick. He's just played a short goal kick, like keepers do these days, to Gabriel, just on the edge of the six-yard box. But for some unknown reason, Gabriel's bent down and picked it up and put it back on the six-yard box for him to take the goal kick. Now, it is clear to everyone that he has taken this goal kick, Raya. But no penalty has been awarded. Surely that's the wrong decision.
I totally agree. I totally agree, Kevin. Yeah, I watched some of that game and some of the other game that was on at the same time, obviously the City game. I didn't see that incident live, if you like, but I've seen it since. I've seen clips of it since. And it's pretty obvious that, you know, the goalkeeper has taken the goal kick with the intention of Gabriel walking onto the ball and then either playing the ball out himself or running the ball out of the box, because he plays it in front of Gabriel. He doesn't pass it to him. You know, it's a 10-yard pass, so he doesn't pass it to him as if to say, you know, this is your ball, you go, you have it. He actually plays it in front of him out of the 6-yard box. Gabriel, as you said, you know, puts his hand on the ball, brings it back in, and then plays the ball back to Raya. So for me, it's a blatant handball. The kick has been taken. The game was restarted. It's handball, and of course should have been a Bayern penalty in my mind.
Yeah, me too. And Thomas Tuchel, he made it perfectly clear after the game what he thought of it in his post-match interviews, and why wouldn't he? I suppose he can leave the Emirates with the crumb of comfort that his side are probably favourites now going into the second leg level on home soil. But there was another incident right at the very end of the game, Craig. Bukayo Saka broke into the Bayern box and came up against Manuel Neuer. It looked like he was going round Neuer to score into an empty net, only for, on first evidence, the TV cameras to sort of suggest that Neuer brought Saka down. But when you look at it at different angles, Saka clearly promotes his leg into Neuer to be brought down. The referee didn't give a penalty. Arsenal were absolutely incensed. Every single English commentator doing the rounds were convinced it was a penalty. Was it a penalty? Should it have been a penalty? Or has the referee actually got to take an awful lot of credit for having messed up the earlier one, getting this one spot on?
I think the referee got it spot on, Kevin. I think he was brave to give it, and he was right to give it as well. You can, when you watch it back, and not even really in slow motion, to be honest with you, you can clearly see Saka sort of move his leg out to make contact with Neuer, as Neuer obviously comes out to close him down. So for me, it's it's not a penalty. And secondly, Saka should have been shown the yellow card for ungentlemanly behaviour. You know, unsporting behaviour. So no penalty. And then you have to ask the question then, you know, Saka one-on-one with Neuer, rather than go for the penalty, why not go around the keeper as he looked as if he was going to anyway, and then put the ball into an empty net?
That would certainly be the question that if I was an Arsenal fan, I would be asking. It was there, wasn't it? You've literally gone round the keeper to all intents and purposes. You've just left your leg there to be fouled, and there's no one in the net. The Bayern defence has been breached and put your side 3-2 up. Go to the Allianz Arena in Munich next week ahead in the tie. Now you've got it all to do. And yeah, could be a big call that. Could be a big decision not to score. And obviously, who knows, that first penalty incident might yet come back to haunt Bayern as well. You mentioned the Man City game, which going along at the same time as this. UEFA really need to sort that out. We need to get some staggered kickoffs taking place in these Champions Leagues, because why would you have your heavyweight competition overlapping each other when you could just as easily split them up on the same night? But that's a different question for a different podcast, maybe. But we did see another great game of football. If anyone had two devices to hand on Tuesday night, Craig, they weren't disappointed with whichever one they put the Man City game on, because I think most people looked at this as the tie of the round. Real Madrid against Manchester City. An awful lot of people are thinking that whoever wins this tie will go on and win the Champions League. I kind of agree with them, particularly if it is Real Madrid who win the tie. I think they'll go on and win the Champions League. And we were treated to an absolute classic, wasn't we? Six goals, two of the best sides in European football, just going toe-to-toe, going right at it, not really caring of the consequences of conceding goals because they were both wanting to score goals. And in the end, we are beautifully balanced going into the Etihad next week with 3-3 draw. What did you make of that one?
Yeah, another great game. And actually, out here in America, Paramount Plus have got a facility whereby you can watch either game live in isolation, or you can have a split screen. So you can watch both games at once, which is the first time I've seen that, to be honest with you. And then
yeah, we need that here. We need that here. TNT Sports, come on. Well, if you're going to overlap them, get them on a split screen.
Well, exactly that.
It's coming Wednesday. Let's have it.
But it's actually quite strange because you're not sure which game to look at, you know. And obviously, what you have to do, you have to sort of time your viewing from one game to the other. So obviously, if there's goal kick being taken, then obviously then you look at the other screen, and you know if they're sort of like progressing play through the midfield and looking to build the attack and getting into the final third, you might watch that for a few seconds, then you're flitting back to see what happened in the Arsenal game with Arsenal on the attack, or Bayern on the attack. So it was an interesting experience, I must say. And I'm I can definitely see the merits of it. And then what would happen is with the Coventry, you would, if for example a goal kick was being taken in the Arsenal game, then what they do, they flip the commentary over to the Man City Real game, where there might be a little bit more of an exciting passage of play. You know, so you could flip. They would choose the audio and they flip between the two. So it was an interesting experience. I'm not sure. Yeah, if you want to analyse one game or the other, I'm not sure if you could get a lot out of it by trying to watch two games at once. But I'm agreeing with you. I'm sure earlier on in the group stages, they had games kicking off at sort of like 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, and then the next game at 8 o'clock. Well, if they can do that for the group stages, why can't they do that for the quarterfinals and potentially the semi-finals as well, you know? So yeah, that's an interesting one. I think you make a great point there, actually, of the staggered kickoff times, because I'm sure, you know, I personally would have loved to have watched, if I'd had the time, to watch both games live and really study and enjoy both games, because you say two fantastic games, you know, six games in one, and four goals in the Arsenal game, superb. So yeah, what a game. And some great goals as well, weren't there? And it was great to see both teams on the front foot and really taking the game to their opponent, respectively. And again, we talked about Phil Foden in previous episodes, Kevin, didn't we? And again, he's come up trumps, you know, with a great goal, left foot drive, top corner. And that's becoming almost a trademark of his now, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I hope it's not a trademark of his on Saturday, I have to say. I think he's come out of the game injured, so I don't think he's going to play on Saturday. But
who are they playing on
the
Saturday?
The goal I like.
Who are they playing on Saturday?
They've got a game that I hope's not going to be as easy as they think it might be on Saturday, mate. The goal I really liked was Bernardo Silva's goal. For all money, the goalkeeper thinks he's crossing that free kick, doesn't he? He comes off of his line, and I don't know when he's seen him, but he's obviously seen him coming a little bit too far off his line. And he's just, well, he's done him, hasn't he? Whether he's done him with the eyes or however he's done him, he's done the goalkeeper. And he just looks a bit, that's something that, you know, Luton need to look out for on Saturday if Bernardo Silva's on the pitch, because it was just a brilliant piece of sort of intuitive thinking, really.
Yeah, it was. It was clever, and you could say it was either intuitive or maybe it's something that the performance analysts have identified. You know, whereby the goalkeeper starting position is more favoured to one side to cover the area where the wall isn't, obviously, and then he leaves that near post area free where the wall should be doing the business. Because if you've got a talented player like Silva who can actually go around the wall, you know, with pace even from that distance, then the keeper's not going to get across, which he didn't anyway. You know, and I remember. You might remember better than I actually who the teams involved were, but it happened at a playoff final at Wembley, and the same thing happened. The goalkeeper went too far one way. The player taking the free kick took it and rifled it into the opposite corner, and the keeper was caught in no man's land. You know, can you remember that one, Kevin?
I remember the goal. I can't remember who it was who was involved, but yeah, I do remember it. And the goalkeeper, he, you know, had egg on his face big time, didn't he? And you're right, it's obviously something that's looked. And Manchester City, you know, just a few weeks ago scored that goal from the corner against Liverpool, didn't they? So it's clearly something they look at with regards to their set pieces. They look at all angles, and my word, did it pay off for them in the biggest game that it possibly could have done. How do you see that tie now, Craig? 3-3 going to the Etihad next week. Are City favourites or are Real Madrid in the kind of position where I wouldn't say they've got nothing to lose because of the level in the tie, but probably most people expect City to go through now. Does that make Real even more dangerous, particularly in light of the fact that they've more than likely they're going to win La Liga in the not too distant future, whereas City are obviously involved in this compelling Premier League title race?
Yeah, it's mouthwatering, Kevin. You know, I'm really looking forward to that second leg, and I'll be doing everything I can to watch that one on split screen or otherwise. But I don't know. I mean, City had a great result against them last time they played them in the Champions League at home, didn't they? And really took them to task. And I'd like to think City will do the same again. But I just think that Real have, you know, if Manchester City leave themselves too open, and we know how they like to play the free-flowing football that they do, and the wonderful passing game under Guardiola. I'm just wondering if Real can catch them, certainly on the counter-attack. And, of course, they had great joy, didn't they, down City's right-hand side with Rodrigo particularly, because there was no Kyle Walker. So they got a lot of success down that one side. So maybe they'll target that again if Walker's unavailable again, you know, for the second leg.
Yeah, I love the tactical element of that, because most people thought Vinicius Junior was going to be the one to benefit from Kyle Walker not being there. And as it turned out, it's Rodrigo that got the goals from that side and set the other one up. Yeah, really, really good. Looking forward to Wednesday night. Come on, UEFA, do the right thing. Get them split up, especially as European time zones are an hour ahead of the UK one. There's no reason to kick these games off at the same time. Just quickly touch on the other two. Quarterfinals, Craig, whilst we're here, one line's really PSG Barcelona. Barcelona have taken a 3-2 lead in sort of the heavyweight clash there. Rafinha, the former Leeds player, got a brace. Barcelona went a goal up, ended up going 2-1 down. Rafinha levelled it. And then former Chelsea player Christensen has put Barcelona in front, and the second leg's at the Nou Camp on Tuesday night. You'd think Barcelona are favourites from there. And the other Spanish team on show on Wednesday night are also ahead. Atletico Madrid, 2-1 up on Dortmund, but that one, the second leg, goes to Dortmund. So there's all to play for. Sebastian Haller scored, former West Ham striker, scored 10 minutes from time to give Dortmund a lifeline in that. Are the Spanish duo favourites there, Craig, or is there still plenty of football to be played in those ones?
They are for me, Kevin, yeah. I think both Atletico and Barcelona will progress, given their one goal leads, that they get my vote. But it's interesting, isn't it? You know, everyone talks about the English Premier League being the best league in the world, ? But there's potential for three Spanish teams to end up in the semi-finals, in the final four, you know, with Real as well against Man City, obviously. So you could see yourself with Atletico, Barcelona and Real Madrid, potentially. Obviously, Manchester City fans won't want that. But yeah, interesting that. And another thing that caught my eye, of course, was the number of goals in the games. You know, we had four games and 18 goals in four games, you know, average of what, 4.5 goals per game. So yeah, a real European football feast, wasn't it, really? And yeah, really, really enjoyable, and some really front foot attacking football in all four games.
And all lovely and well set up for next week. So make sure you check them second legs out. They're going to be special, particularly that Man City Real Madrid one. That is perfectly poised between two of the biggest and best sides in world football. It's not the only sort of area where there's lots of good football being played, Craig. The Championship was going alongside these Champions League quarterfinals, and I think we just love this division, don't we? Top, middle or bottom is something to play for. It's fantastic. But we've had the weirdest midweek of all. I think if you'd said to me Monday night, ahead of the midweek fixtures, Leeds, Leicester and Ipswich are all going to play. They're all going to play against comfortable opponents, and none of them are going to score a goal based on what they've done so far this season, where they've been the three standout sides in the Championship. I'm not sure I would have believed you, but that is exactly the case. Leicester failed to score at Millwall, lost 1-0 to an absolute thunderbolt from Ryan Longman, who pinged it in the very definition of the postage stamp. Leeds drew 0-0 with Sunderland. Sunderland played a lot of basketball in that game and got away with it. Two clear handballs not given. And then Ipswich drew 0-0 with Watford on Wednesday. Ipswich did hit the post. Nathan Broadhead hit the post, but it come out in that game. But all three, they looked subdued. Whether they looked subdued because of the pressure of this compelling title race, or whether it's literally just a bit of fatigue after a pretty hectic spell in the Championship, it has to be said, I'm not sure. But all three had their chance to steal a march on the other, Craig, and all three have missed out.
Yeah, they have, haven't they? You know, obviously, those results are totally unexpected, you say, especially the lack of goals. But, you know, you've got to consider as well, you know, these teams have just come off a really tight Easter weekend schedule, obviously, two games in really short space of time. Then they've got the weekend game. Then you've got another midweek game almost straight away as well after that. So four games in a really, really tight period of time. And it's interesting, actually, I read a piece by Enzo Maresca, the Leicester City boss, who said he's worried about the health of his players because... you know, the number of games they played, and obviously the travelling as well. You know, they've got to go to Plymouth Argyle, I think it is, at the weekend. You know, so that's a particularly long trip for any team. I mean, that's
Friday night too.
There you go,
Friday night game.
There you go. So it's a quick turnaround again, you know. And I think he was quite critical of the EFL for scheduling this week's games. Obviously, as you said, yeah, with the game being moved. To the Friday night. And of course, you know, teams played on Tuesday night, got back early hours of the morning, and then they got to go again then. They got to go back then down to prepare, or not prepare really, they probably got to recover rather than train. Recover, probably do some analysis, probably do some match prep, and then go again for that journey down to Plymouth, which obviously they're going to travel down on Thursday or maybe even Friday morning. Then get to a hotel, and what teams tend to do then, they have their pre-match meal, they get there, players then sleep in the afternoon, they get up for a pre-match meal, and then of course they make their way to the ground and play the game. Maybe it is that, Kevin, maybe it's fatigue, maybe it's that the team's against them, set up not to concede and do a defensive job on them, knowing how good these teams are. There's lots of factors, aren't there, you know, but it still remains that the top of the table's tight. And, you know, goodness me, you know, if you have a look at that, you've got Leicester on top with 41 games played with 88 points. Ipswich have played a game more in second on the same number of points. And Leeds on 42 games played, same as Ipswich, a point behind on 87. And we've always talked about Southampton within this triumvirate. Being the fourth team, obviously, because they got two games in hand on both Ipswich and Leeds in fourth, but on 78 points. So 10 points behind that second place automatic position.
And as we said a number of times on this podcast, it's Leeds against Southampton last weekend of the season. Leicester still play Southampton in a midweek, in 2 weeks' time, I think it is as well. So plenty of matches between the top four. Incidentally, you're right, Leicester at Plymouth on Friday night, Leeds at home to Blackburn Saturday lunchtime. Blackburn come off the back of an absolute stuffing at Bristol City on Wednesday night. Ipswich home to Middlesbrough, on paper at least, the hardest of the three games, but the other two fighting for their lives. So it's going to be another interesting sort of time of it at the top of the Championship this weekend. We'll quickly touch on the bottom of it as well, Craig, because it's just as tight down the bottom there. What are Birmingham's owners thinking right now, Craig? Because they sacked John Eustace earlier in the season. They were sat in sixth place in the Championship. They're now running out of games massively. They've got four games left in the Championship season. They've gone through Wayne Rooney and spat him out the other side. Obviously, it's unfortunate what happened to Tony Mowbray. They've now got Gary Rowett as an interim manager. They've dropped to second from bottom, from sixth in the table earlier in the season. Surely, if they have their time again, they're keeping hold of John Eustace, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But, you know, he was doing well there. He's proven in this division, in the Championship as well, John Eustace, you know, and I know other clubs were looking at him when Birmingham appointed him. And clearly he was doing a good job in sixth position, as you said, in the playoff places. And now they find themselves second from bottom, you know. Obviously, the owners decided to go down the Wayne Rooney route and appoint him, hoping obviously for far greater success than he was able to achieve. Tony Mowbray came in, as you said, and unfortunately he's on sick leave at the moment. And Gary Rowett is now left, you know, holding the difficult task of trying to keep Birmingham City in the Championship. But yeah, really strange decision in the first place by Birmingham City. And yeah, you know, sometimes you know, you reap what you sow.
Yeah, indeed. Home to Coventry City for Birmingham on Saturday before a trip to Rotherham, which looks absolutely huge. If you're a Blues fan, we'll keep up to date with the Championship as we do throughout on the Director's Box podcast. But before we go, Craig, let's look ahead to two huge matches this weekend in the bottom two divisions of the English Football League. We'll start in League One, where Derby have opened the door big time with only a draw against Wickham on Wednesday night. Wickham, of course, who lost very agonising circumstances in the Bristol Street Motors Trophy final to Peterborough at the weekend. And fair play to Peterborough, well done for winning the EFL Trophy at Wembley. Local lad Harrison Burrows scored another injury time winner to give Peterborough the title. They won that 2-1. First goal in that game was late in it, and Wickham looked like they'd forced extra time, only for Peterborough to score a winner. But Wickham, to be fair to them, they rebounded. They got a draw against Derby, and that has set up a huge clash on Saturday. It's third against first. Bolton host Portsmouth. Portsmouth can win the league on Saturday with a win. If they better or indeed match Derby's result at the weekend, Portsmouth will be up in the Sky Bet Championship, and they'll be there as title winners if they beat Bolton on Saturday. Bolton are in third, though. If they win and Derby lose, Derby are at home to Leighton Orient, Bolton will go above Derby with just three games left in the race for automatic promotion, and we shouldn't rule Peterborough out of the equation. Their win on Wednesday night against Port Vale has seen them move to within 6 points of Derby. They're in fourth with two games in hand, so this is another one of those compelling races. But Bolton against Portsmouth, two teams who shouldn't be in League One anyway. They're far too big for it. It could be a defining day, Craig.
Again, it's, you know, what a game to look forward to. That is Portsmouth against Bolton. You know, Portsmouth win, they win the title. Bolton, if they win, you know, potentially they could go into the second automatic promotion position. So, yeah, that's going to be a great game to watch. And but as you said, you know, Derby, Leighton Orient, you know, Leighton Orient in 10th, 62 points. Oxford occupying that last playoff position on 70 points with three games to go. So, you know, a lot of teams play 43 games. Others have played 42. But Peterborough, as you said, have played 41. So potentially they've got two games in hand. 6 points potentially would take them level with Derby. Yeah, so, you know, again, fascinating top of that table as well, you know, and all to play for.
And the same in League Two as well, Craig, because they're a week further ahead in their schedule. Their season finishes a week before the Championship. So for most teams, there are just three games left. The third to last game coming this weekend, and that is the case for Milton Keynes Dons, who are in fourth on 74 points. And their opponents are Mansfield Town at the MK Dons Stadium. Mansfield just 2 points ahead of them. They have played a game less, but just 2 points ahead of them. So if Milton Keynes win that game, they go into the automatic promotion spots with three games left for Mansfield. And if you think back to last season, Mansfield were clinging on for a playoff place and they missed out late on. They've got history of missing out late on in seasons. So that is a huge, huge game in Buckinghamshire. Of course, if Mansfield win that game, they would go 5 points ahead of MK Dons, who would only have two games left. And you've got to think then the automatic promotion spot will be theirs at some point. But there is everything on the line in that one, Craig.
Yeah, another fascinating game, Kevin, as you said. And just looking at the current form of both teams, so Milton Keynes, they've won three and drawn one of the last six, whereas Mansfield have only won two, drawn one and lost three of their last six. So, the last three games have been two losses and a win for Mansfield, whereas Milton Keynes are unbeaten in the last three. So you'd say current form is with Milton Keynes, and they got home advantage, obviously, as well. And of course, if they win that one, then, as you said, you know, they go point above Mansfield, although Mansfield got game in hand. But it is a proverbial six-pointer, isn't it?
It really is. Yep. Second best home record in League Two against the second best away record in League Two. So who knows who's going to win that? One thing that we do know for sure is if Mansfield win that game, or even if they avoid defeat in that game, Stockport County will be promoted to League One, regardless of what they do against Morecambe. But they'll be promoted either way should they beat Morecambe. And at some point, you would think the Hatters are going to get promoted. They're 4 points clear of Wrexham with a game in hand and games running out. So looks good for Dave Challoner's men, Craig. It could be this weekend that their return to League One is confirmed.
Yeah, it could be, Kevin. But as far as the title's concerned, you know, as you said, you know, it's Stockport have got, four games left. Wrexham have got three games left. And Wrexham are 4 points behind. So, you know, having said that, Stockport have won the last five games they've played. So, you know, their current form is exceptional. Having said that, Wrexham have won four of their last five. You think that Stockport would take the title, but we know what football's like, Kevin.
We do indeed. Yep, that's why they play the games. That is for sure. A huge, huge day at the top of EFL League Two on Saturday, and we'll have all the reaction to it in next week's podcast. That's pretty much it for this week, Craig. Thanks very much for your insights, particularly in line with that striking discussion that we had right at the start of the podcast. How does the weekend look for you?
I've got three games this weekend, Kevin. A shorter journey than down to St. Louis last weekend, that's for sure. But we've got three games away. So, yeah, very much looking forward to that, and very much looking forward to both the Premier League programme and the EFL.
Yep, some brilliant games to come this weekend. And as I say, we'll react to them all next week. It's a trip back to one of the nastiest places I've been as a Luton fan, the Etihad Stadium. For me, at the weekend, Luton played the AFC Wimbledon there in the conference playoff final in 2011 and lost on penalties. And it was the worst day of my Luton supporting life. Not least because the final penalty the penalty that made the difference, someone Panenka'd it and the goalkeeper didn't move and he looked a right prat and condemned us to what turned out to be another 3 years in the conference. So I'm hoping for a happier experience on Saturday. I'm not sure I'll get it because Manchester City look like they're in the mood to do some damage on someone. But what will be. I'll enjoy the experience, Craig, and I'll be back with you next week.
Okay, well, enjoy the game, Kevin. Win, lose or draw, and have a great weekend, and a great weekend to our listeners as well. And we'll speak to you soon.
Absolutely. If you do go to a game this weekend, enjoy it. Be respectful. Most of all, make sure that you make lots of noise for the team that you're supporting. We'll be back next week. So until then, thanks for listening and goodbye.